supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Known as transgenderism. Children born as one gender but identifying with the other. Well, 17-year-old Ty Clark was born a girl biologically, but by the time he was two, he told everyone he was a boy. Now imagine spending your life feeling uncomfortable, different, and being made fun of by friends, even teachers. Today, Ty and his parents, Rory and Matthew, will tell us their story, what it means, what it really means to be transgender. We'll also join on the phone by Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. She's a clinical and research psychologist in the Gender Management Service at Children's Hospital in Boston. Let's say hi to you first, Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And let's begin with you, Ty. I had said that when you were 2 years old, you told your mother that you were a boy. How did you know that?
It's really, you just know, you know? It's not, it doesn't feel right. It's like waking up and having like your arm asleep or something. You just know something's wrong. And it just didn't connect because you look in the mirror and then there's this whole different person staring back at you. It's just not you. And this whole different body. And you think, wait a sec, you know, something's off here. It's supposed to look the other way. And I didn't really know exactly what was going on because I was a little kid, but I didn't feel right. Something was off. I just wasn't the right body.
How did you understand that? Did you think there was something wrong with you, with your body, with your mind?
Yeah. I thought God was just playing a trick on me. I was just really stunned. I didn't understand. And I thought my parents were lying to me because I would come into the kitchen or, you know, different places and they say hi and address me as a girl. And it just dumbfounded me. I had no idea why they were doing it. I thought they were just playing a prank on me. It didn't fit. And I would get very angry with them because they were addressing me as a girl.
What age?
Do you remember? As far back as I can remember.
You would get angry at them.
Yeah, I was furious. Huh. It didn't fit, and I didn't understand why they were doing this to me.
I would think. Let me turn to you, Laura. Mm-hmm. It's pretty unusual for a child that age to be that assertive and that clear. Yes or no?
Well, I think for children who are experiencing this is often what we see is that they are very clear from a very early age. So that seems to be the case with a lot of the patients who we see in our clinic here, actually.
Well, that's good news. I guess it could be bad news also, because you're running afoul of the world around you.
Right. It can be very upsetting for the children at a young age, for sure. That's right.
Let me turn to you, Rory. So you hear your two-year-old little girl starting to tell you she's a boy. What was that like for you when you first started hearing it? Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember that we just assumed that she meant that she wanted to be like a boy. That looking out at the world and seeing what all the gender stereotypes of what boys and girls are, that our child preferred the stereotypical boy things. But we didn't know that there was a possibility that he actually was male. We just thought he had a preference for what boys liked to do.
Like a tomboy kind of thing.
Yeah, like a tomboy, boys' clothes, boys' games. Although he never was a tomboy in the sense that I was. As a girl, I liked playing with the boys. I liked playing sports and basketball and baseball, and I was usually the only girl. Ty didn't do that. He didn't really want to do those kinds of things, so he wasn't a tomboy the way. So there were a lot of disconnects all along until we actually got a diagnosis when he was 12. There were a lot of disconnects between what he was saying and what we believed to be true.
That's a long time, 2 years old till 12 years old. Matthew, at what point did your anxiety start to go up, that it was more than just Ty wanting to be a tomboy?
I think there was really just a long process. It really plateaued. I mean, when as we're hearing that Ty was maybe two-ish, would say, "I'm a boy," and we would try to interpret that for him and say, "Well, okay, honey. I mean, I know you think that, but you just like to do boy things, and and it's okay. Girls can be all kinds of things. Girls can be dainty. Girls can be rough. Girls can be athletic, and that kind of stuff." And Ty would argue back and say, "No, I'm a boy." And I think that we kind of had that out at a pretty early age, and then I think we reached sort of a detente or kind of a plateau that all through, the early years of elementary school, there was just this sense of, okay, we've reached some sort of equilibrium. We know that Ty is a very masculine kind of girl, has very kind of masculine expression, but that's okay. That's who Ty is, and things are okay. I think, in terms of when things really became more of a crisis was when Ty hit puberty.
Let's back up to get to that detente. I recall there was a point where you let Ty dress in boys' clothes, and then there was another point where you sent him to an all-girls preschool.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that process, Rory.
Yeah, we always let Ty choose his own clothes. From the time he was four, he chose what he wanted to wear, and it was always...
I hated those tight leggings he used to make me wear.
Yeah. He has a sister that's 8 months younger, so I like to dress them as when they were little girls. It was kind of fun to put them in dresses, but at the time he was four, he stopped. And then by the time he was in preschool, we thought we'd send him to an all-girls school so that he could see there was a wide range of expression for female, because again, we were still knowing at that point he was boy-ish.
Right. I mean, we weren't trying to squash his maleness. We were more saying, the sending to the all-girls school wasn't, boy, we'll teach you, we'll fit you into this mold, come hell or high water. It was more saying, okay, well, let's let him see that what he's experiencing actually could be expressed in this wide range of what it means to be a girl.
What was that like for you, Ty?
It was interesting. I can't say that I hated it. I mean, I hated having to fit in this all-girls stereotype, but I didn't really pay attention to that. I was still the tomboy. I mean, I was really popular, but I just remember we used to play this game where we'd, marry each other, and there were always, the brides and the flower girls, and I was always Ken, and I was always the guy that was getting married to these people, and I was always... Tom, we'd play house and stuff. It was never even an issue of trying to be more like a girl. It just didn't come naturally.
What was it like being different? You knew you were different than the other kids. And there's a level at which you knew your parents weren't getting you.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like?
It was frustrating, definitely. Even though I had a lot of friends, I was really alone, because nobody understood me. And so I would wake up and sort of get myself together and look in there and say, okay, in 10 years, God will be through with this trick on playing on me, and it'll all be over. I won't grow up like a girl. This is just all a trick. I'll just go through this day. And I actually really believed that I would grow up as a boy. I thought this was just a temporary stage. And I had... no idea, but yeah, I knew I was different, but I guess I always just believed it would end, so.
It's amazing. The human mind just takes my breath away. What your mind did to help you cope with it.
Yeah.
I want to know from you, Rory, about when you first began to realize that this child was not the child you thought she was, that there were big things going on here that was something you didn't expect.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons we were so grateful to you for doing this, because I think from the time Ty was very young, we were in a help mode. He was tested many times. He had learning issues. He had, when he talks about, this was sort of an aha for me listening to him say he was angry at two, because by the time it was almost at two, he started having these fugue states where he would just be enraged without words for sometimes half an hour at a time, and the only thing I could do was hold him until it was over, and that would happen 2-3 times a day. We were in play therapy. We saw therapists. We went to psychiatrists. We had learning disabilities. We just were in the test from the time he was, say, 4 until 12, and nobody ever diagnosed this, that said that it could be an issue of gender dysphoria. And the minute we got the diagnosis and he started living as a boy, many of those things went away. So I think it's, we always knew there was something challenging. He's always been a challenging kid to raise for a lot of reasons, to help him cope, get his, to help him be who he is. But now that we understand why he was struggling so hard.
I want to understand something before we turn to the doctor in Boston and see what we can generalize. I want to know what it's like for you. We'll start with you, Matthew, on a personal level. What it's like having your child shift their gender identity.
You know, I really, at an emotional level, I don't feel like it made a big difference. It's, you know, I could love my little girl, I could love my boy. I mean, it didn't feel, that aspect of it actually didn't feel so upsetting. I think I remember having this sort of pit in my stomach, kind of really, you know, anxiety kind of feeling, was more like, oh God, you know, what is this going to mean for him? I mean, when we sort of got that, it's like, it's fine, you know, to have a kid who's, you know, a tomboy or who's going to be lesbian or whatever. It's like, you know, more power to her. We'll figure out a way to make it through the world. I think that for me, that deep fear was just getting that diagnosis and saying, well, what's this going to mean for this kid? You know, how is he or she going to make their way in the world? You know, how's the rest of the world going to respond? What does it mean physically, medically, socially, schools, jobs? You know, that's really my recollection of what was the most, the hardest, was the most upsetting.
Do you still have those fears?
Yeah, but a lot less. I mean, I think that we've all been really pleasantly surprised at how accepting the school system has been, for example. Ties in a really large public school, you know, a high school with 1,600 kids, and they've just been terrific, you know,
yeah,
mostly.
I want to get to those details. Let me turn to you, Laura Edwards-Leeper. You work with children as young as 5 years old. I'm sure families react to this in all kinds of ways.
Yes, I think that is true. However, the patients, the children and families who we see in our clinic are generally very supportive, because typically they've been dealing with this issue for some time, or if they're as young as 5, you know, it may be more recent, but they're usually already connected with a mental health professional who's been helping them sort through their gender identity confusion. So typically, in our clinic anyway, the family members are quite supportive.
Well, and my guess is you've got a biased sample there, because they've got to be supportive to even bring them to the clinic. I wonder about the others.
That's right. No, I think that our sample is definitely biased at this point, because our clinic is new and pretty small. But absolutely, I think that, you know, there are definitely families out there who are very resistant to this, and those are the families that, you know, we're at this point not able to reach out to on an individual level, but hopefully through programs like this, you know, they will learn ways to be connected.
In February, almost a year now, Children's Hospital in Boston started this gender management clinic. Tell us what you do, and I'm also curious about the politics of getting it started.
Sure. I was hired as the clinical psychologist to conduct the comprehensive psychological evaluation that we do with all of the children who come in, and also to provide input then based on the results of that on the most appropriate treatment options for each patient. And then we're also developing research protocols. So, but the clinic was actually, it was created to provide a comprehensive interdisciplinary clinical care to children and adolescents struggling with a variety of gender identity issues, so both questions of transgender as well as disorders of sexual development, otherwise known as intersex disorders. So that was sort of the reason for the clinic beginning. And Dr. Norman Spack, the endocrinologist who's one of the co-directors of the clinic, has been doing this work for some time, and so it was really because of him that we were able to get this started, and with the people, others in the hospital, the higher-ups, that were in support of this. So we were very fortunate.
Hmm. I wonder how many of these programs there are around the country.
Not many. Not many programs, particularly. I believe our clinic is the only clinic in the United States, maybe even North America, that addresses both transgender and intersex issues in the same clinic, and it's just having an interdisciplinary clinic like this is pretty uncommon, actually, which is quite unfortunate.
So, Ty, when you were 12, you got to the right psychologist, and you got the right diagnosis, gender identity disorder. Are you comfortable with that label?
Not at all, because I think every kid really doesn't want a label as to why they're different or even that they are different, because that really puts me in this box that says that I am different. And when I tell people that I have that, they're like, what? You know, what are you talking about? Instead, I can't ever say that I'm like normal by the normal like stereotype of what normal is. So I don't think any kid ever wants to be even put in that position where they have to be classified. I couldn't just be me. So I really, it was, you know, on one hand, it was nice to know what was going on with me and that I wasn't just crazy, because that was my big concern. I was really scared. So it was nice to know what I was, and so I could start from there and go on to how do I, you know, fix it or how do I deal with this. But it was frustrating.
So you're arguing that you are not disordered in some way?
I hate the word disorder. It makes me feel like, you know, a freak, because in school, they just really, I mean, if you say you have a disorder, they think you should, you know, be upstairs with the kids in, like, the special classroom, which I don't like that word. It makes me feel like I'm just different, and, you know.
How do you understand that? I mean, you are different than the other kids. You always were. Does it feel different today to be different than it did when you were 10?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something I'll carry with me for the rest of my life. So I think I'll always be different like that. But it's changed since from when I first was diagnosed that now I'm sort of proud to be different. I'm not ashamed of it as much. I still wake up and wish that I wasn't like this a lot, but it's to the point where I can, you know, hold my head up high and tell people that I'm, you know, transgender. It's not as much of a big, you know, issue as it was.
I just remember you being almost euphoric. You know, I'm thinking back to when that diagnosis came. It was like suddenly the world was giving you permission.
Yeah, a chance.
You know, you just loved it. We'd go places and you'd say, I'm going to go as a boy. And, you know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, it was just like this load off your shoulders. I mean, I hear that, you know, you'd rather not be given that diagnosis if you had your choice. But given that you felt the way you felt, it seemed like once you had permission to you know, some way of understanding, that was a huge relief.
Before we go to break, Rory, what's happening with you? There's tears in your eyes.
Yeah, you were trying to get at this a little earlier with the questions about what it feels like. And, you know, here's a kid who, when he was two, all he wanted to do was be a boy. And he thought when he hit puberty, that's what would happen. God would make him a boy. And then when we got the diagnosis of trans at 12, I think there was a little bit of that still going on, that finally everyone understands, so it's all going to come together, and I'm just going to be a boy. And there have been these different events along the way, his decision to have surgery. He had chest surgery last week, and I think with each of these, there's a sense, a part of him that, and me too probably, that, okay, this is going to make him a boy, a real boy like Pinocchio.
Like Pinocchio.
And he's bi-gendered. He's just, whatever word we're going to use for it, he's...
Well, I wouldn't call myself bi-gendered.
And the tears in your eyes, Rory?
I want him to be him. I want him to have a full and happy life. I don't want him to have to suffer. I don't want him to have to explain himself to every new person he meets. He has a girlfriend right now, and the parents reacting a lot like what you would expect somebody who doesn't understand this would react. It's been horrible.
Well, yeah, we're going to have to take a short break. I want to come back and talk about the biology. You'd mentioned Ty had surgery this summer, and I want to talk about the relationship with your girlfriend and your peers. We are talking with Ty Clark and his parents. He's 17 years old. He carries the label gender identity disorder, whether it fits or not. That's his label. He was born a girl. He identifies himself as a boy. His name will be Tyler.
Tyler Michael Clark. I was born Ty Michaela.
Okay, Clark. And his name will be Tyler. We're also joined by his mother, Rory, and his father, Matthew. I'm also joined on the phone by Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. She's a clinical and research psychologist in the Gender Management Service at Children's Hospital in Boston. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Tomorrow, NPR and Iowa Public Radio will host a Democratic presidential candidates debate. We will ask the questions about the issues that matter most to you, from national security to the economy to immigration. Join us for the questions and the answers that will help voters decide this primary season. The Democratic presidential candidates debate from NPR News.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about gender identity disorder, and using that phrase now feels like chalk on a blackboard to me after our previous discussion. My guest is Tyler Clark. He's a 17-year-old high school junior, born in a girl's body and now lives life as a boy. His mother, Rory, who is an executive coach with Take 10 Now, and Matthew Clark is his father. He's a doctor by trade. He teaches at Abington Medical Center. I'm also joined on the phone by Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. She's a clinical and research psychologist at the Gender Management Service at Children's Hospital in Boston. Laura Edwards-Leeper, we talked about gender identity disorder. Is it really a disorder? I'm struck by the word gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if I had a chronic toothache, I'd have dysphoria, but I wouldn't want to go to a psychotherapist. I'd want to go to a dentist.
Well, this is definitely something that's debated quite a bit, and I can completely understand Tyler's uncomfortable, you know, feeling uncomfortable, I guess, with having a diagnosis like that, and it's something that I think that the tide may be turning a bit. I don't know for sure how things are going to go here, but basically, I think, you know, gender identity disorder is a category in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and it's used to, you know, identify individuals who are struggling this way and to develop treatment plans for them. So, you know, it's a category, it's a label, and as with many of the DSM diagnoses, there can be problems with that.
What happens? I want to talk to Tyler about puberty, but what happens to these children during puberty? It's a time of dramatic change in their bodies, brains, hormones.
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. I think that, you know, the kids, the adolescents who we see coming in who are just starting puberty, It's very upsetting. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to hear what Tyler's experience was, but when all of the hormones and everything are making it impossible for them to ignore the fact or ignore their biological sex, that can result in all kinds of psychological problems like depression and anxiety, as well as self-harming behavior, suicidal thoughts, and that sort of thing. So it's definitely a time that is incredibly challenging and in our view, an important time to intervene.
The Dutch are prescribing medication for transgendered kids going into puberty.
That's right. They've been doing a clinical and research protocol for a number of years now, where they prescribe a medication that suppresses puberty for children, just for young adolescents. And it's been very effective. They do have all of the children coming in go through a very thorough psychological evaluation to be sure that, you know, they're good candidates for the treatment. But of the 50 or so that they have gone through, who have gone through this protocol, none have changed their mind at the end. So that's what we're modeling our protocol after as well.
Hmm. All right, Ty. When she said none have changed their mind, you looked out of the corner of your eye at your mother. So, well, yeah. you can't do nonverbal communication in front of a psychologist. You know, right. You're going to get caught.
Right.
So, what was the message?
Well, I think my mom's always been sort of, she wants to leave the door open in case I do change my mind. I mean, she's very supportive and she knows, you know, 100%, I guess, that this is what I'm going to do, and so she's supportive. But at the same time, you know, she doesn't want me to get any irreversible surgery or anything like that because I just, what happens if I, you know, change my mind?
So what surgery have you had?
I've had a mastectomy, which is the removal of, like, right. the breast, you know.
And how was that for you?
Painful, but it was really such just a release because I had sort of bottled up all this negative energy for years and years, and finally I get this surgery where I can take off my shirt. I can wear one shirt because I was wearing like 7 shirts even in really hot weather, and it was
just to hide your breast.
Yeah. And it was just really amazing. I mean, words can't even describe it.
Are you going to go further? Do you want to go further? Do you want to have pelvic surgery?
I've considered it, but I think ideally I would, just because for me the definition of what it means to be male is to have, you know, all male genitalia, just for society, so I can show them, you know, hi, you know, I am male. So ideally I think I would, but at this point I've decided against it just because, yeah, it looks real, but, you know, you don't get much feeling there, or in terms of when I see myself in the next, like, you know, 10, 20 years, I want to be married with kids and stuff. So I think the best decision for me would not get it. Just so I have the option of, like, just not ruining that part of me, I guess.
Do you feel clear at the moment? As clear as you can be?
In terms of getting surgery? No. I mean, not as clear as I am about, you know, being transgender, but it's, you know,
right.
it's a hard decision to make, and at this point, no.
Let me see if I can start some trouble in your family here.
Because we haven't had enough.
Right, exactly. I'm wondering who you can talk to about this. Your parents are wonderful, but mm-hmm. it seems like they've got their own agenda, wishes, fears.
Yeah, they work a lot.
And they are parents.
Mm. I've always been close with my parents. I've always been able to come to them whenever I need them for anything. But part of me, there's just part of me, I think, is scarred from when I was little going to them and having them not hear me that I was a boy. I think part of me is sort of apprehensive. But on the other hand, I just, you know, I don't even, I feel weird talking to them about it sometimes. It's because the issues that I have now are so different from what I had before. I mean, they're mostly just, you know, girl problems or such, but I just, I don't really know who I can go to. I don't really talk about it that much, I don't think. It's just not an issue with anyone, so I don't know how to talk about it.
Do you have a therapist?
Yeah, but we really, you know, we don't really talk about it because it's not a problem. You know, it's like, so what if, you know, you're living with an arm you can't move or something? You know, it's just, yeah, it's inconvenient sometimes, but I don't, you know, it's not a big deal in my life.
Let me turn back to you, Dr. Leeper. What kind of counsel do these children get, need?
Well, we recommend very, very strongly that children, younger children coming in prior to getting to an age where a medical intervention may, you know, be a possibility, that the child and the parents be in some sort of family therapy, just, you know, to help figure out what's going on, because not all of the cases of gender dysphoria, you know, in young children end up, you know, those children don't always end up becoming transgender. So it's really good to get help from a mental health professional who has some background in training and gender identity issues to sort some of that out. And then when they come to our clinic, you know, especially for the evaluation to be considered for a medical kind of intervention at early adolescence or then at later adolescence, you know, we do the evaluation and then, again, highly recommend that they continue in some sort of therapy to work things out during the time that they're going through adolescence and, you know, their brain's developing more and they're able to kind of think through what's going on a little bit more. Basically, the medical intervention to suppress puberty, the idea behind that is just to buy them some time, you know, before any irreversible treatments are given.
So let's go back to the family here. And you get the diagnosis when Ty's 12, the middle of puberty, and at one point all of you agreed that you're going to make this gender identity shift and he's going to start going to school as a boy. Tell us about that process. And anyone want to tackle that first? Mm-hmm. Let's start with you, Roy.
Well, we were, it was fortuitous in a way that the psychologist that we ended up with, who gave us the diagnosis, I think she'd been seeing Ty for a couple of months. We were worried that he might be schizophrenic because he was doing a lot of role-playing games, really locking himself in a room and pretending to be a guy without, it was just very intense. And she's the one that first said, I think he might be transgender and that doesn't go away. So that was that, you know, that pit in the stomach feeling. But within, I think, 2 or 3 days, there was the Trans Health Conference here in Philadelphia. That's a national conference that we were able, Ty and I went to.
What is that?
It's a conference. I'm not exactly sure which one we went to, but this might be the one that's sponsored by the Mazzoni Center.
Yeah,
in the spring. Yeah, every year. And it's a conference where people from all over the country come and talk about, there's lots of different workshops on trans health issues, psychiatric and physical and everything else. So we went to that, and it was just as though the lights went on. And then we found there's a camp called Mountain Meadow that's in Jersey, South Jersey, that's a camp for the children of parents who are gay, lesbian, or trans. And they were willing to let Ty come there and do whatever he wanted, experiment, explore, live in the girls' tent, live in the boys' tent. They didn't really have any fixed way of being, so he was able to spend the summer.
How was that for you, Ty?
It was fun.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah, to not have that boundary
freedom,
of,
right.
Yeah, you know, having people say, you know, this is what you have to do.
So what happened at school the next year? Matthew?
Well, I was looking at Roy because I really give you credit. I mean, you did a wonderful job of working with the school authorities. I mean, we were in the process of figuring out what was this going to look like? And were we going to, some people in this situation choose to move to, try to be anonymous. Let's go to a whole new school district where nobody knows and we'll just start as a boy or start as a girl. And in thinking it over, we decided we really wanted to try to make things work within the school system that we had. So Rory really had a lot of contact with the administrators, the principals there, and they were really wonderful. It basically took the position of, absolutely, you know, whatever this kid needs to make this work, mm-hmm. we'll make sure that we do it. And so we thought a lot and talked about how best to do this and decided to really kind of just take it head on. And so what we came up with is, at the first day of school, they had initial assemblies, and they did little things on diversity and those kinds of things, and we kind of dovetailed that in. We had about a half hour, 45-minute assembly with several hundred of Ty's classmates, and got up, the school psychologist introduced what it meant to be transgender. We had a little clip from Oprah, a show she had with some people talking about it, and then just kind of got up and did sort of a mock interview and asked Ty questions and took questions from the audience, from the students. And so it was very, you know, there wasn't sort of that little wedge of like, you know, if you really want to tease me and make a big deal about this, I'm really vulnerable. It was the opposite. It was saying, you know, here we are, very matter of fact, we're transgender, I'm transgender, and this is how I'd like to be treated, and boom.
How are your peers? How were your peers?
I have this vivid memory of just the silence, there wasn't even, you know, there was some whispering, but it was just quiet, and just walking up there, and just, man, I was just shaking, I was so scared, it was the hardest thing I've ever done, but it was just quiet, and it was just, I mean, that's the only memory I really have. I was talking about it, but just have all these people, the entire eighth grade, staring at me a couple times in a row, and it was just, ugh.
Did you feel raw, exposed?
Yeah. I mean, I might as well have been naked standing up there, because this is, you know, telling people this very personal thing about me, and I didn't, you know, this is my life. I'm not going to run and hide to a different school district where no one knows me. I grew up with these kids, but it was just,
Were you angry that you had to do that?
No, the only thing I was really thinking about was, you know, boy, this is it. You know, I chose this, and if this doesn't work out, then, you know.
Hey, Ty, how do you feel about yourself?
How do I feel about myself?
I'm a psychologist. That's really the only question we know how to ask.
Like, in what way?
I'd run with it.
Well,
how do you feel about Tyler?
Oh, I love Tyler. Tyler's a great person. I mean, you know, I'm funny. I'm fun to hang out with. I'm just like your average kid, but, you know, I have this, you know, dark secret in my past, you know, but I love myself, really.
It's a great way to go to our break. When we come back, you know, we've talked a lot about psychological issues and some social issues. I want to talk with a lawyer about some legal issues. We're going to be joined by Ellen Fisher, who's a family service lawyer in Pennsylvania. She had spoken with Mike and Scott, and we'll hear a bit from her. But today, right now, you're listening to Tyler Clark. He's a 17-year-old high school junior who was born in a girl's body and now lives life as a boy. His mom, Rory, is an executive coach with Take 10 Now, and Matthew Clark is his father, family doc by trade, who teaches at Abington Hospital. And we're joined on the phone by Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. She's a clinical and research psychologist in the Gender Management Service at Children's Hospital in Boston. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and with PNC presents George Balanchine's The Nutcracker, December 14th through the 31st at the Academy of Music. With 192 costumes and 24 hand-painted sets, this new production will take audiences on a journey to the land of the sweets, where dancing is set to Tchaikovsky's classic score. This is a performance for audiences of all ages. For tickets, 215-893-1999 or paballet.org.
Between Morning Edition
and All Things Considered,
we bring you Day to Day. news, interviews.
If they get to me and they kill me, I can always leave something behind.
And features you won't hear anywhere else.
It's good radio in the middle of the day.
Day to day from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about transgenderism today. And like I said, we've spoken about many of the psychological and social issues affecting transgender teens. But what about the legal issues? Are there laws that protect their rights? And what potential problems could they face in the future? It's a new area, and there aren't a lot of case law about this on the books. Our producer, Mike and Scott, spoke with Ellen Fisher. She's a family lawyer in Pennsylvania and the president of the Family Law Section of the Montgomery Bar Association.
It really is an evolving area of the law. I mean, there's only two reported cases throughout this country. There are now about 12 states that have passed laws prohibiting discrimination as the result of any gender identity issues. In fact, what we now know is that it's considered a disorder. It's known as a gender identity disorder. And the good thing about that is now that it's a recognized disorder, even though you don't want to consider that person handicapped, it gives them some of the rights and legal rights that a handicapped person has. Specifically, there must be appropriate accommodations made for teenagers in school who have gender identity issues. For instance, schools must accommodate use of a bathroom, gym classes, allowing a teen to dress in whatever gender they identify with.
Can you tell us a little bit about the cases that have been in court so far?
Sure. There's a case out of Massachusetts from 2001 where an eighth grade student was born biologically a male but identified as a female. And the school would not allow her to dress as a girl. So she filed a lawsuit, and ultimately what the court said is that she, as a person with a gender identity disorder, has the right to be accommodated. The other case, another really interesting case, came out of New York in 2003, and in that case, a 17-year-old boy was placed in an all-male foster care facility, all boys. And he identified as a girl, and they did not want her to dress as a girl within the facility. And again, the court said, as a result of the gender identity disorder, this person is entitled to accommodations, and if she feels much more comfortable dressing as a girl, then you are going to allow her to dress as a girl.
What about families who live in states where there are no laws concerning this issue on the books?
People are relying on the United States Constitution, and I think that one of the reasons that there is such little case law is that when these issues get raised, they get resolved in a positive way. And two of the laws would be the 14th Amendment, equal protection. These children argue to their school districts that they're entitled to equal protection under the law. And the other one is the First Amendment and being permitted to, you know, speak their mind and to dress as they would like to. We have a First Amendment right. I was in touch with the National Center for Lesbian Rights. I learned from them that transgender and gender identity youth are becoming, they're just out there more. And so the schools are just accommodating them quietly and without as much problems as one might expect.
I assume that a teenager who may be contemplating going through the process of changing his sex, that they have to get permission from their parents, correct?
Correct.
So do both parents have to agree? How does that work? I'm sure some of the families, the parents are divorced or it's a one-parent household.
Well, it would be different in each situation. If it's a married, intact family, then both parents would need to consent. In a divorced family, if one of the parents agrees and the other doesn't, we're looking at the best interest of the child. So in that case, I would file a petition on behalf of the parent who is in favor and say, we believe it's in the child's best interest to be permitted to adopt the gender identity that they're most comfortable with, and let the court decide, probably bring in one or two experts, therapist, you know, who specializes in this sort of disorder to testify for the child's behalf, and the same in a single-parent household. When parents get divorced, they usually share, it's called sharing legal custody, which is the right to make major parenting decisions. So they're either both on board or the court will need to get involved.
That was Ellen Fisher. She's a family lawyer in Pennsylvania. You can find her online at fisherlawoffice.com. She spoke with Mike and Scott earlier. One of the many issues she brought up is the good news about having the label disorder. I'm curious about your reaction to that. Tyler?
The label disorder.
Well, she said because you have a label disorder, then the law protects you. The law says they have to make accommodations.
That's good. That makes me happy to know that. I didn't know that. And I feel more protected in terms of the law, not against, you know, society or people like that, just because part of the problem is that we're just not educated enough. But I think it's definitely a step up to have a law like that passed.
Yeah, sure is. Helps a lot of people, myself included.
Yeah.
Tell me about your girlfriend.
Well, we go to the same school. I met her through her mom. What kind of stuff do you want to know?
Well, how's the relationship? How is she with all these changes?
She's,
how are you?
She's really great. I mean, she has no problem with it at all. She defends me when other kids say things. But she spends most of her time defending me against her parents. Her parents really, they accepted me on a level when we weren't dating, but as soon as we started dating, they just flipped out. They thought it made her lesbian because, you know, she's dating someone with, you know, who's biologically female. So it was really a big issue with them, but our relationship's really great. And it just, for the first time, I'm dating someone who's just a really whole person like that, and it's great for me.
And you're attracted to girls?
Yeah.
Exclusively?
Yeah.
So there's it needs to be said, there's a difference between gender identity and
sexuality.
Sexual identity.
Yeah, I consider myself straight because I like girls and I'm a guy, so.
Let me turn that back to you, Laura Edwards-Leeper. Part of the clinic's function is to learn about etiology. What are we learning?
Well, our clinic is very new, so our research protocols are just being developed, but we really don't know much at all at this point. Continued research is really necessary in that regard.
I think what we're hearing here with this family is kind of the ideal. Yes, it certainly. I would doubt that it's typical.
This is the ideal, particularly, I think, with the school being so supportive. You know, I think to have both parents and, you know, the community, school, whatever it is, be as supportive as in Tyler's situation, you know, that is really ideal. And but that is not that's definitely not the case for all of the kids going through this.
What happens to transgender kids?
What happens to them typically?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I heard the suicide rate sky high for these kids.
Yes, it's really, there have actually just been a couple of new studies in the last 2 years that found that the suicide attempts for transgender youth ages 25 and younger was greater than for older people. So it was actually 47% for under age 25 and 30% for over age 25. And a lot of the trans youth identify their gender identity as being a major contributing factor to suicidal ideation, you know, thoughts of suicide or attempts, even more so than gay and lesbian youth, actually. So, you know, that's one extreme that occurs, but there are all kinds of other, psychological problems that can that we believe are a result of, rather than just, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
What are the chances of these kids having a happy life, and what needs to be done to make sure that happens?
Well, we really feel that identifying this early is the best way to ensure that they'll have a happy life. If we're able to start, prescribing the hormone-suppressing medication so that we can prevent the onset of the secondary sex characteristics from occurring, it just makes, first of all, it buys the adolescents time to sort things out, and then when they're at an age where they can make a decision about doing the more irreversible treatment options, it's just much easier to do because, for boys, their voices haven't deepened, their Adam's apple isn't visible, facial hair, body hair, all of those sorts of things. For women, breasts haven't developed, and so the medical transition is just much easier, and it's much easier to sort of quote-unquote pass as the gender that they feel they are.
Where should a family take a child when they have an experience like the Clark family did? Where should they go?
Well, I guess, it's really important to find a mental health professional, whether that be a psychologist, psychiatrist, or a social worker, who has a background in this and is familiar with the recent literature and research in terms of best treatment options. And that can be tricky depending on the part of the country and, the area that you live in. But to have someone like that to help kind of guide the child and the family through the process, and then to make a connection with an endocrinologist who's willing to prescribe the necessary medication, that's, for cases when that's warranted, that's really the best option if the family can do that.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you, Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper, clinical psychologist in the Gender Management Service at Children's Hospital in Boston. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ty, you're amazing. You're right. I would love to hang out with you. It seemed like a fun kid to hang out with. Tyler is Clark is a high school junior. Is born in a girl's body. She now lives life as a boy. Rory Cohen is Rory Clark is Ty's mother.
Cohen. Yeah.
An executive coach with Take 10 Now. Matthew Clark is Ty's father. He's a family doc by trade. He teaches at Abington Medical Center. If you want to get archive editions of the show, you can find them on my webpage at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Bob Purdick. Gita Simons helped production of today's show. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott, and I'm Dan Gottlieb.